Couple brief items before we get into the hearing on House Bill 3942. I sent a memo out to your offices today. Starting the week of April 9th, committee will start, we'll move up our start time to 1 o'clock. Based on the volume of bills, it's time to ramp up a little bit, so we'll start at 1 o'clock beginning the week of April 9th.
No more 3 martini lunches.
That's right. Down to 2. But that does not apply to April 9th itself, because April 9th is the day that we will be meeting jointly with the Senate in Portland. Anyway, there's a memo coming to your offices. Just want to mention that. And Paul, before we get started, do you want to just tell us what we have on our desk here on these revenue impact bills?
Mr. Chair, you recall the committee had requested on Wednesday that we start to go ahead and formally do what we've been doing informally, and that is keep a chart on revenue impact measures that have passed either the House or the Senate revenue committees. And so this is what this is. This is an ongoing tab for you to see what has gotten through.
Watch your P's and Q's.
So the one distinction that I made here is on the total versus the sunset, those that are sunsetted. And that's, I think, particularly true on the property tax side. For example, when we do the estimates of local school revenue, which we're, by the way, working on now, an update for you, but we haven't included those sunsets in the previous forecast. So that does not represent a subtraction from our local school revenue estimates. But this gives you a sense of where you are now. And so we'll be keeping track of this and be distributing this every couple of weeks or so.
Good. Yeah, it looks fun.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Beck?
I am maybe missing something. Maybe that replied to the sunset remark. But I'm looking, thinking about the tax credit we passed for reforestation.
Representative Beck, that's House Bill 2161, increases reforestation credit $500,000. We do have just the 0103. I think that jumps from $900,000 or 0305.
Cursory glance, can't catch it. Thank you.
All right. Let's go ahead then and move into a public hearing on House Bill 3942. I'll open the hearing on that. Just a couple of introductory comments of mine before I turn it over to Paul. This committee is the Revenue Stabilization Tax Reform Act that we have been shopping around for the past month or so, and for the benefit of the members and also for the people who are here and listening in by internet. Paul and I have spent the last month or so meeting, of course, with members and with various representatives of the different interest groups that are represented here in the building and outside the building. We've been to Portland and on the phone a number of times. At this point, the bill is pretty much, I would say it's still a work in progress, but for those of you who may have participated in some of the overviews that we have presented, it's going to be about what you saw. Today we will spend some time with invited testimony only, giving the exposition, explaining what the bill is, having some conversation among committee. It's up again for a public hearing on Monday. We'll have some more invited testimony and probably will begin public testimony on Monday as well. We'll be having a series of hearings on this as we go. With that, just to kind of set the stage, Paul, let me turn it over to you and ask you to introduce us and the folks that are in the room here to what we are looking at.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I put together a summary packet under the title of House Bill 3942, Revenue Stabilization Tax Reform Act Summary Packet. I thought I would go through that with you to answer any questions you have in terms of the outline of the packet. Talk a bit about the rationale or the problem statement here that the package is designed to deal with. When I'm through with that, we have Tony Ruffalo from Portland State University will talk about how a business activity tax fits in with some of the other alternatives. What are the economic effects of a tax of this nature? And then Bruce Weber and Ed Waters will talk about the OTIM results and look a little bit at this post-VAT revenue system, what it would look like, what would be its characteristics. And then we've asked Bob Alexander and Debbie Cannon from the Revenue Department to talk about administrative issues around a tax that's such as one outlined in 3942. The first thing I'll call your attention to is the basic outline of the package itself, and I do have a single-page static revenue impact estimate, and that just has the pieces kind of outlined for you. These are all ones that I think you've all been briefed on. It consists of a broad business activity tax at 2.5%. Again, all of these are flexible in terms of rates and how the various characteristics. Personal income tax reductions amounting to $1.3 billion. This would be for the 03-05 biennium when it would be fully phased in. Reduces capital gains tax rate to 5%. Reduces the personal income tax rate for the top marginal bracket to 8.5%. Establishes the earned income credit at 15% of the federal. Now it's 5%, and now it's not refundable, so it would be a significant expansion. And it increases the personal exemption credit by $40, roughly about 30% of its current level. It would eliminate the corporate income tax. You can see the revenue impact of doing that. And it does have it's not actually in 3942, but as a part of the package and how we've modeled the response of the economy is with a senior property tax relief program amounting to about $100 million a year. So the net revenue of all of that is a plus 64.
The senior property tax relief, that's in the nature of an income tax credit.
Yes, we, in terms of our OTIM presentation, we have treated it as a property tax reduction, but yeah, the assumption is it would operate to something along the lines of the previous homeowner program, elderly rental assistance program. The first part of the summary packet has a what I call a problem statement, and the problem is, I think it's pretty straightforward. That's Oregon's tax system is too dependent on income taxes. And just to refresh you on some of the numbers, I have printed out the 1999 state tax collections by source, and that's in the packet. And actually, there's several things I'll refer to in that grouping. But that has all the states and their reliance on specific tax revenue sources. There's no non-tax sources here. So property sales, selective sales, or excise taxes, individual income, corporate income, and other. And, of course, the key number in here is to look at Oregon and to go over under personal income tax, 69.4% of Oregon's state income tax collections are from the personal income tax. That is the highest number for any state in terms of income taxes, and it is the highest number for any state for any single tax revenue source. So the state's dependence on the personal income tax is indeed unique among all 50 states.
And Paul, I guess just maybe you'll get to it, but to refresh us, the capital gains component of that, at least in the past couple of biennium?
Mr. Chair, we've estimated that given the rapid growth of capital gains over the last 5 years, that about 10% of personal income tax collections are attributable to capital gains. So that's about $800 million for this biennium. A couple of things also included in this chart, and that is as we look at a weaker economy, I think most economists will tell you that we could very well be in a recession now, but I think clearly the consensus of nearly everyone is we're in a much slower economy. If you look at a chart that came from the Rockefeller Institute in New York that did an excellent article on fiscal issues for the next 10 years, but they were looking at the states in terms of some trends, and they used a standard forecast done by Regional Financial Associates to look at Oregon's gross state product over the 95 to 2000 period, which we were picking up the investment boom and semiconductors, was actually the highest in the country. And by 2000-2005, they had Oregon as a slightly below average state, but the key point is the biggest deceleration of any of the 50 states over the next 5 years, and indeed we're well into that trend now. We're below 2.8% over the past year in terms of real growth. The final point is, in terms of the stability of the system, again, back to the chair's point on capital gains, the relative importance of capital gains. This is from the same study, and what it does is takes a combination of capital gains as a percent of adjusted gross income, which Oregon is not real high on. We're a little bit above average, but not real high on it. But the key is that, in terms of our revenue system, we're extremely dependent on the personal income tax. And then if you multiply those two together, we rank second by this measure in terms of dependence on capital gains or importance to the revenue system. So that, of course, adds a significant element of volatility to the revenue system as we look at trends over the last 6 months in the financial markets, particularly the equity market. So the point being, as we look at a system that is highly dependent on the personal income tax, is that, first of all, this leads to an unstable revenue system. The personal income tax is the tax that is considered the most elastic by economists because it is sensitive to income. And what this means is that it will tend to grow fast. It will tend to grow over the long term, tend to do well in periods of economic growth, to do very poorly in terms of revenue collection during periods of downturn. So it is very sensitive to economic conditions and therefore relatively unstable over the business cycle. The second point is that the personal income tax is the tax that is most closely tied to current productive activity because it's based on income produced by various means, either through capital or through labor. So what it does is take a share of those current returns, and therefore economists consider it to be have the most significant effect on economic growth, particularly within an open economy where factors of production, both labor and capital, can move easily between the states. So therefore, over time, the general consensus, and indeed empirical evidence to back this up, there is a growth retarding effect of personal income taxes at the state level. Not a huge effect, but a subtle effect over the long term that slows economic growth relative to other tax revenue sources. The solution that's laid out in this tax reform package, well, the solution is pretty straightforward, and that is to diversify the revenue system. The issue, of course, comes in how it's going to be diversified and what are going to be the alternative to choose from. I've listed several of them, and these are all in the context of trying to achieve a change in the tax system that would be revenue neutral, that would keep revenue about the same, but would look at different sources to diversify. The alternatives are probably not a surprise to anyone that I've listed there. They're basically consumption-based. They're the retail sales tax and the gross receipts tax and the value-added tax. Tony Ruffalo is going to go through those with you and what some of the alternatives are. And the business activity tax, as laid out in House Bill 3942, is a form of a value-added tax. The value-added tax is a tax that we do see in some other states. There is one that operates in Michigan, the single business tax. Dexter has used some of that Michigan law as a basis for House Bill 3942, and we can talk a bit about that. The Revenue Department has talked with officials in the state of Michigan about how that tax operates and what kinds of issues come up. The other state that has a similar tax is New Hampshire. And if you look in the back of your packet under the Appendix B, I have included, I think some of you have seen this, but I have included the tax forms from the state of Michigan and from New Hampshire. The thing to keep in mind about New Hampshire is that New Hampshire also has a business profits tax or a net income tax similar to our corporate income tax. So their what they call their business enterprise tax is a complement to that business profits tax or net income tax. As you look through the business activity tax, there are some key policy decisions that need to be made. We have used some numbers as we've looked at some alternatives, but I see these as very important policy decisions in what such a tax will ultimately look like. The first is a filing threshold, which could be based on gross receipts. This would determine who has to file. We've been looking at 100,000 as a gross receipts threshold. A lot of businesses fall under that. There's a lot of very small businesses. But that would be something that you could vary in terms of who would have to file under this revenue system. The second issue would be a zero bracket amount. How much of the business activity would actually be non-taxable? And that's something that again, would be a policy parameter. And when you think about business activity and you think about it compared to our current corporate income tax system, the corporate income tax is embedded within that business activity, but it also includes all returns to labor, all wages, all payments to labor, all returns to capital, which would be depreciation and interest paid. It also includes land or rent. So it's just the three factors that are used to produce something. What is the payments to those factors plus the net income becomes the measure of business activity. So it's a much broader base than is the corporate income tax. Therefore, the rates can be considerably lower, in this case 2.5%, yet yield considerably more revenue. It's also should be a more stable revenue base. In terms of the final piece I have there on the key policy decisions to make is on apportionment formula. The business activity tax for multi-state corporations, business activity would still have to be apportioned just as the corporate income is apportioned now under the corporate income tax. And the apportionment formula to be used, 3942 uses the current double-weighted sales formula, but that would be an important policy discussion and decision for you to implement a tax like this.
This doesn't avoid the apportionment issue. We have to decide that in the context of implementing this new tax plan.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. In fact, there's another element to this, too, that I've been talking a little bit with the department about, and that is the way the bill is written now, you calculate all of business activity, then you subtract out capital expenditures. So capital expenditures are not part of your current activity. They're added back in when capital depreciates. So the way the bill is written, now capital expenditures are actually apportioned. So again, that becomes an issue where you decide on how those capital expenditures should be apportioned for any multi-state business. The revenue system that would come into place as a result of this bill, and again, Bruce Rebel will talk more about this, but certainly it's a system that in our view would be more stable in the short term because it's substituting a less volatile tax, business activity tax, for a more volatile tax, the corporate and personal income tax. And it would also keep in mind that there is a trade-off here between stability and growth. Because the system would be less elastic, it would tend to grow more slowly over time with respect to income in the economy. So it wouldn't have the built-in rapid growth over time in our current system does, or certainly not as much. I do want to emphasize the stability notion that the system would be more stable, but certainly it would be tied to the state's economic performance. I mean, there's no way around that. When we went into recession, this revenue source would dip as well. It just wouldn't dip as much proportionally as the current system.
I guess in my mind, you said if the national economy catches a cold, we catch pneumonia under the income tax based system, under the BAP. If the national economy catches a cold, we catch a cold.
Right.
Fair enough.
Fair enough.
Achoo. Bless you.
Finally, the last thing I've listed here is some clearly identifiable risks, and these are of course an important factor in your decisions. When you look at any type of major tax reform, it's important to recognize that regardless of the weaknesses of the current system, that decisions, economic decisions, have been made based on that current system. And so when you introduce another system, there is going to be some transition costs that have to be borne within the new system. So that becomes an important policy decision to have transition rules and ways to help taxpayers to make a transition to a new system. But there are costs involved, and those have to be weighed against the long-term benefits. I think clearly a message that we have gotten over and over again from Michigan is that excessive use of exemptions and deductions can erode the base. And if you do that, you introduce a couple of fundamental tax problems. One is you begin to create economic distortions because you're favoring one sector over another. And that tends to raise its head as equity concerns. People say it's not a level playing field. Why is this industry tax less than mine? And it also begins to erode the broad-based, the stabilizing effect of a broad-based tax. So a base erosion, when you go through a process like tax reform, can be a major risk. You end up with a product that doesn't do the things that you'd hope to in the beginning. Finally, there is a concern with a value-added tax at the state level. And that is that the competitiveness of businesses that compete in international markets, they're in a different situation than a business that would be producing and selling in Oregon. Because the whatever change you get in the tax system will be built in the cost structure of those domestic industries and will be part of the mix and basically would be passed on to consumption. For industries that are selling outside the state, this becomes a more important policy issue. To make sure their competitive position wouldn't be harmed. So that would be a significant policy issue for you as well to deal with number three without falling into the trap of number two. So you can see that some of the trade-offs there that you get into is you're dealing with any tax reform pact.
Okay. Questions for Paul at this point before we go on? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul, do you know what New Hampshire's business enterprise tax percentage is and what their corporate income tax is and how they blend those two?
Representative Witt, their business enterprise tax is very low. You can see the rate there this is Appendix B. I've got the New Hampshire form there. It's 0.005, so it would be line 4, enterprise value tax base times 0.005 would give you the estimated tax burden. The amount of dollars they collect from their business profits tax are a multiple of this, I think probably 3 to 4 times what they collect from this. So they've designed this. Of course, the New Hampshire situation is unusual because they don't have a sales tax or an income tax or a personal income tax. So this was designed to be a complement to their business profits tax rather than a substitute for it. But if you put the two of those together, I think you have a better, that would be more similar to what the VAT would look like in terms of its base.
Yes, Nick.
Follow up. Paul, the other question is, have there been any studies done to indicate the ability of a business to pass on a business activity tax to its customers through its pricing structure?
There has been quite a bit of analysis done on the effect of value-added taxes at the national level. And I did also make a copy of Robert Ebel's article on value-added tax at the state level that I think gives you some interesting background. But one of the things that Ebel points out is that there are over 100 countries who have a value-added tax. In fact, the U.S. and Australia are the only two major ones that he says that don't have a value-added tax. So there's a lot of experience at the national level with this type of tax. And at the national level, it becomes very similar to a sales tax in its effect. So it is passed on to consumers at the national level.
Doesn't it create a challenge for businesses that are selling product out of state to the extent that it's origin-based?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The origin-based issue, and I know Dr. Ruffalo will talk about that, but it's a issue that most countries, for example, the European community countries, they have a credit. Of course, their value-added tax is very high. It's over 15%. So they have a credit for exporters, but they're not paying that value-added tax, so it becomes a domestic tax that then acts like a consumption tax in the local economy. But they're also, I mean, the EC countries are exporting over 30% of their economy in many cases.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Beck.
I wonder, Paul, if you can comment a little bit about the administration of this tax and whether it's different or how it differentiates from what we're doing now in terms of efficiencies within the bureaucracy and so forth.
Representative Beck, I'll save some of the details for our Revenue Department experts, but I can say a couple of things in terms of the overall goal here. And we looked at the issue, and this could be something to revisit as well, but we took the approach of calculating the base by then what's called the additive method, and where you would add up labor returns and capital and rent. Another way of getting to the same base would be to take gross receipts and subtract all purchases from business, and that would give you the same theoretical base. But the sense in working on this bill was that people are familiar with the income approach because it's used for both the corporate and personal income tax. So you've got that structure in place. So really what it's designed to do and what Dexter was trying to do when he was writing this is to make it as to not use any information that is not already used in the corporate income tax. And in fact, when we went through and calculated the base, which I do have also in Appendix C in the back of your packet, the business activity base arrayed by gross receipts, that base estimate is from the department. So they went in and took their tapes on federal corporate income returns and summed up these components that are in the bill to get to that base. So they use the information off the current corporate returns. And that's the way the bill's written, to use that same information, just add it up differently.
Well, we do have Bob Alexander and Deborah Buchanan who will come up at the end to talk about the administrative side of this from the Department of Revenue.
For a general.
Other questions at this point before we bring up our... Okay, thank you, Paul. Let's invite Bruce Weber and Tony Ruffalo and come on forward. Yes, Representative Hass.
I was just curious, were the OTIN...
Oh, did you want to talk about OTIN yet, or did you want to come back to that?
We're going to save OTIN for... Bruce and Ed can talk about it.
Ed, you too. Who's next? Is it Dr. Ruffalo? Okay. Welcome.
Representative Shetterly, other committee members, I'm Tony Ruffalo from Portland State University, and I've been asked to give you sort of a broad economic overview of the pluses and minuses of the sort of broader-based taxes that have been discussed, the sales tax, the gross receipts tax, and the value-added tax. Generally, the goal, I think, at this point is to broaden the tax base, and from an economic perspective, what you want to do is tax the broad base at a relatively low rate. It creates the fewest distortions and creates the least economic inefficiency relative to the amount of revenue that's going to be generated. Now, the most well-known tax clearly is the sales tax, and it is used by a large number of states, and it's a major revenue source. The issues that you run into with the economic perspective on the sales tax, forgetting about any of the political issues as to whether it would be viable or not, basically depend upon the base that's going to be defined. If you look at the sales tax, it is generally identified as a consumption tax, and it is intended to be paid by the consumers. The issue that typically arises is that many services are also consumed extensively by businesses, and because of the potential for taxing indirectly businesses and getting what we call a cascade effect, most states end up exempting most services from the base. This substantially reduces the base, and it basically focuses the sales tax on goods. The effect of focusing the sales tax largely on goods is twofold. One, it narrows the base, which means that you then have to raise the rate. And two, if you look at consumption patterns, you observe that as income increases, a larger percentage of the income is spent on services relative to goods. So by exempting most services, the sales tax becomes a relatively regressive tax. That is, the poor, while paying less tax, actually pay a higher percentage of their income in sales taxes. A variety of states then try to address this regressivity by exempting what they, quote, quote, call necessities. Food, medicine are the major ones. The impact of this is to further narrow the base and to lead to an additional increase in rates, which creates additional distortions and problems within the tax base. The other effect of this is that we observe over time, because real incomes are increasing, what we observe is that people are spending relatively more of their income on services, which are not taxed, and relatively less on goods, which are taxed. And so the states that rely heavily upon the sales tax are finding that they have to continually raise the rate in order to maintain the same percentage of revenue that they were generating previously under the different consumption patterns. In addition, we're now observing that catalog sales and e-commerce are further eroding the base. And so there are a number of issues then that are raised with respect to a sales tax as a revenue source. The final issue is that it tends to be paid by state residents. It is a consumption tax, so that, for example, sales tax in Oregon would be expected to be paid by Oregon residents. Most of the analyses that have been done in the past indicate that there would be very little tax exporting. Okay. The second major tax that was identified as being broad-based that could also be provided at a relatively low rate was the gross receipts tax. And as I'm sure you're aware, Washington has a gross receipts tax. The benefit of the gross receipts tax is that it can be levied at a fairly low rate to generate fairly large amounts of revenue. The problem with the gross receipts tax is that it is basically a turnover tax, and it can cascade over multiple purchases. So, for example, if a business purchases services from another business and then sells services or goods to another business, the ultimate effect of the gross receipts tax can be widely varying rates on the final product. This can create distortions with respect to consumption of goods and services because of the differing net rates that you end up with. And it also creates a substantial incentive for what we call vertical integration. A large firm that provides its own accounting and legal services and provides most of its own inputs would have an advantage over smaller firms that purchase these services from other firms, because every transaction gets taxed in a gross receipts situation. So the problem that you with respect to cascading creates a number of distortions, and so from an economic perspective, it is typically viewed as being a very poor tax. And there are relatively few states that still have anything like this. You'll also, if you're interested in history, you'll note that most of the European countries had gross receipts taxes that were eventually replaced by the value-added tax. So if you're looking in terms of experience with respect to the different tax bases, what we observe are that the countries that relied heavily on gross receipts taxes found them to be sufficiently distorting that they eliminated them in favor of value-added taxes. I'd like to spend the rest of my time. One other concept with the gross receipt is that it's not related to any particular concept of tax liability. It's not related to ability to pay. It's not related to benefits. It's basically related to turnover, and you can find that some firms have a large amount of sales relative to their economic activity. Others have relatively small sales relative to their economic activity. So there's no particular relationship to any forms of activity that are generated by that tax base. The value-added tax, as was mentioned, is widely used throughout the world, with the United States and Australia being the only two major countries that do not have value-added taxes. Now, the value-added tax is a sort of chameleon in a sense. You can create a value-added tax to do a number of different things. There are several aspects of it that are that can be manipulated to change the broad nature of the tax. If you look at the European taxes, you will find that they are largely oriented towards consumption. And basically, when you look at them at the national level, the net effect of the tax is that it is a national sales tax. When you look at the tax itself, however, you can modify it in a variety of ways. At the national level, it can be formed so as to tax consumption, or it can be formed so as to tax income. And it can, you know, the specific items that are included in the base determine whether you're taxing generally consumption or generally income, although the bases tend to be pretty similar, even at the national level. The other distinction that we tend to make is between whether we are taxing the origin of the activity or the destination of the activity. A destination-type tax is, again, more of a sales tax. And what you observe in the European uses of the value-added tax is largely a destination-based consumption tax. And so what they will do, for example, is give a credit for items that are exported, and any imported items will be subject then to the tax. So the effect of this is the base is oriented towards consumption, and by making it a destination rather than an origin tax, you're further refining it to be basically a sort of national sales tax. And a lot of the literature will refer to it as being a national sales tax. The difference between a national tax and a state tax is based upon the ability to track sales inside and outside of the state's borders. In general, when we look at a state value-added tax, the tax that is levied at the national level in most European countries becomes somewhat unfeasible. Basically, we don't have a good ability to track the value of goods that are brought into the state from outside or to subtract most of the sales that occur outside of the state. So in formulating the tax, rather than using the European notion, which is to look at final sales and to subtract off the cost of inputs, you can look at the tax in a different way, get at value added by adding up all of the productive activities in the state. And the tax that's been proposed here for Oregon is basically this consumption base, so that the definition of it is that it's taxing consumption, not income. But it is based upon the origin. So it is really a production tax that is oriented towards the production activity that occurs here in Oregon. The intent of the tax, then, is that it is to be more of a benefits tax. Basically, the economic principle is that economic activity also requires certain state services, and that by taxing the economic activity, you are orienting it towards more of the benefits that the business receives rather than the alternative, which is the ability to pay, which is the way we typically look at the evaluation of income-type taxes. The other basic benefits of the value-added tax are that because it is a broad-based tax, it can be levied at a relatively low rate. If it is levied with relatively few exemptions or exclusions, it is a fairly simple tax to administer. It creates relatively few economic distortions. And most of the analyses that have been done indicate that a wide base, low rate, value-added tax creates substantial improvements in economic efficiency, in addition to the benefits that it would generate in terms of stability of revenue for the state. The other basic issue that, going back to the issue of the sales tax, because it is a broad-based tax, it does impose taxes on services. And so the large growth that we're seeing of services relative to goods would be captured in the tax base, whereas for most sales types taxes, it would not be. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I hope that gives you sort of a broad overview of the different tax bases.
Dr. Ruffalo, one I guess that I would ask, you mentioned the effect of e-commerce and catalog sales with respect to sales tax, and I guess I'd ask you to address the same issue e-commerce in connection with the business activity tax as is proposed in 3942.
Because the business activities tax is an origin-based tax where you basically look at the activities within the state, the labor, the land rents, the capital, and so on, sales become less of an issue in determining the tax liability. Basically, you're adding up all of the activities in the state to determine the tax liability. You're not necessarily looking at sales. Now, as a matter of implementation, that may enter into the apportionment factor, but you do not lose the base because of those types of sales. The activity itself is what generates the tax liability, not the sale of the final product.
Other questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions on this, and the questions I posed earlier. Number one is, do you feel that a business activity tax can largely be passed on to consumers of products? And secondly, How is this, how could this tax potentially create a competitive disadvantage for Oregon businesses to the extent that they are selling products across interstate lines or competing with products that are coming from a different state into Oregon?
Okay, as with any cost to business, and this would become a cost to business, the ability to pass it on depends, from an economic perspective, on what we call the elasticities of supply and demand of the products. And basically, what you need to know for any particular for any particular business are the nature of the markets in which they sell and sort of the elasticity of demand for their product. What we would expect is that goods and services that are produced in Oregon for consumption in Oregon, where the demand would tend to be relatively inelastic, that the tax would then largely be passed on to the consumers within the state. On the other hand, for items that are largely sold in national markets and outside of the state boundaries, we would expect that the demand for the state's output is probably fairly elastic, in which case the business would be unable to pass that on. The world market price, for example, of agricultural products is determined in a huge market in which Oregon would be a relatively small part of the market. And hence, the part of the tax then that is levied on goods that are produced for sale in world markets would largely have to be absorbed by the producers, just as any of the other costs associated with the activities would be.
Or accommodated within the tax plan.
Or accommodated within the tax plan, or possibly shifted backward to other factors of production. For example, it might end up with lower wages rather than specifically affecting the ability of the firm to compete in the world market. The real issue is fairly complex in terms of both the forward shifting and backward shifting of any tax. The one thing that I would point out is that the VAT is at a relatively low rate, and because it is at a low rate, it is less likely to have really substantial distortionary effects.
Well,
you did it, huh?
Yeah.
Would companies that are out of state that simply export product into the state, would they be captured by the VAT? Would those sales be captured in any way?
The VAT, as it is currently defined, is an origin-based tax. And so even though it is on what we call the consumption base, so that it is taxing consumption, it is consumption-based of the final product that is generated here in Oregon. So if Oregon residents are consuming a good that is produced outside of Oregon, it would not be subject to the value-added tax, except to the extent that the retailer adds value by providing services to the consumer.
Anything else? Dr. Weber.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Weber from Oregon State University. What I'd like, Ed and I are going to talk about the Oregon tax incidence model results, but my role here this afternoon is really to set up that discussion, in a sense to review what you've already heard about the criteria that economists use to judge tax systems. The Oregon tax incidence model addresses some of those but doesn't address others, and I guess I'd like to just start by going over a handout which should be in your packet about the various criteria that economists use to judge tax systems. Looks like that.
Two pages.
Starts out with how would the business activity tax proposal affect Oregon's tax system. Economists usually use five criteria to evaluate whether a tax improves or a tax change makes the system better or not. Those five criteria deal with the stability of the system. Does it make the system more stable? Does it make the system more fair? Fairness is a complex issue, of course, and there are several ways of looking at fairness, which I'll review in a second. How it affects economic competitiveness and the efficiency of the system, the economic system. How it affects the simplicity of the tax filling out process, the computing tax liabilities, and also its effect on the adequacy of revenues that to fund the services that the state or local government wants to fund. Those are the five sets of criteria. What I'd like to do is just review briefly how the business activity tax affects each of those five criteria. As you've heard from Paul earlier, the the BAT proposal, as it's currently outlined, would stabilize the system. It would substitute a more stable tax for one which is more volatile. In terms of fairness, there are two ways of looking at fairness, and in both of the ways that economists tend to look at fairness, it looks like a business activity tax would improve the fairness of the system. The first way that economists think about fairness is the benefits principle. Tony referred to that earlier, and that holds that a taxpayer should pay taxes in proportion to the benefits that that taxpayer receives. This tax, because of the way it's set up, would, if you think that that business activity, value added, is a measure of the benefits that, or is proportional to the benefits that a business receives, then a business activity tax does, in fact, tax business on the basis of benefits received. The other principle, and the one that we'll talk about that the tax incidence model addresses, the other fairness principle is the ability to pay principle, which is that taxpayers should pay taxes in proportion to, that high-income taxpayers should pay at least a higher proportion of their taxes as low-income taxpayers. As we'll see in a minute, it looks like the Oregon tax, it looks like the business activities tax does reduce taxes which are currently high on low-income classes and on the highest income class, and slightly increase the taxes of the middle-income groups, flattening out the system, making it more proportional. In terms of competitiveness and efficiency, the third criterion looks like as Tony has indicated, and in response to your questions, Representative Witt, it looks like it would increase the efficiency of the current system. And because it would reduce the personal income tax in a state that has high income taxes, there's some reason to believe it would increase the competitiveness of the overall economy. I think Paul has addressed the question of simplicity. It looks like this tax would, in fact, not have much of impact on the simplicity, since most of the information that's needed to calculate the tax is already being collected and already by businesses. Paul also addressed the revenue adequacy question, which OTIM addresses, and it looks like this proposal would raise about the same amount of revenue as the current system raises in the short run, and slow the growth of taxes in the long run. I'd like now to turn it over to Ed to talk specifically about the findings of the Oregon Tax Incidence Model.
OTIM. Thank
you, Bruce, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be working from the sheet, two-sided sheet, which starts with OTIM results feedback effects on what we will call the front. We had to first tailor this tax package in a chunk, which OTIM would swallow, and it took some took some art, but I think...
We're just learning how to feed it, is that...
OTIM did swallow it, and we're hoping now that you will, too.
Can I just ask, who's responsible for OTIM over the weekend?
He takes him home.
Yeah, that's so.
Yeah.
Representative Williams, he's for rent.
Your house broken in.
Breaking houses every day. First thing I would point out is that the static revenue impact numbers on the OTIM results page don't look quite like the static revenue impact estimates on the sheet that Paul handed out originally. And the reason for that is because the impacts the static impacts that are fed into OTIM are annual impacts, and they've also been scaled so that they're in proportion to the 1997 snapshot of the Oregon economy and Oregon tax system that we currently have in OTIM. So the important thing to get out of these results, first feedback effects results, I think, are the percentage changes and the percentage feedback effects. The table shows, as I said, first the static revenue impact estimates, block below that the total revenue impacts, of which the dynamic revenue change is a component. And finally, at the bottom, the economic effects that are underlying the total revenue changes. For example,
the table shows that the static general fund revenue impact is plus $155 million. However, the actual total general fund revenue impact is plus $140 million. So you basically net $15 million less annually than what you set out to do with your tax rate changes, et cetera. That amounts to a minus 10% feedback effect. Because this is a complicated package of tax increases and decreases affecting revenue elements both in the general fund and in local revenue stream, i.e. property taxes, the results for the local taxes look a little bit interesting. The static local revenue impact is minus $89 million. The actual local revenue impact is minus $77 million. So you actually don't give away as much as you had intended due to the economic changes going on in the model. A lot of that is due to the feedback effects from changes in the other tax components. The upshot is that the total state and local revenue effect, if you compare the static total with the actual total, the actual is 4 million, actually 4 million more than the static total, which amounts to a plus 7% feedback compared with the estimated total static revenue change. Now, where do these results come from? The economic effects table shows summarizes some of the effects going on in the model that result in the revenue changes. You see that, for example, the personal income measure falls slightly, but net household income increases. And net household income is a measure that we use to gauge changes in household welfare, basically, or change in tax burden. Net household income in this model is total household income minus the amount that households have to spend for their household taxes, income taxes, property taxes, and charges embedded in their consumption purchases, the taxes embedded in their consumption purchases. So as I stated, personal income is down somewhat. Net household income is up, largely due to the reduced income tax burden. Gross wage index is down, but employment is up because investment is up somewhat in response to the increased return to capital. The changes are fairly small for all of these measures, but you can see the direction of the change from the table. Finally, with respect to this table, the consumer price index that we've used is slightly down, largely due to the reduced labor costs resulting from the lower income tax. Any questions on this first results table?
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed, why would local revenues drop so much?
Representative Witt, members of the committee, that's a very good question. The way the chunk that was fed to OTIM included individual components for the tax changes. There was a BAT rate increase. There was several discrete personal income tax changes. And senior property tax relief component was modeled as a reduction in property taxes.
But if, in fact, if that is treated through the income tax system, can't we discount or ignore basically that local revenue impact? That becomes then a hit on the general fund and not to local government.
Representative Shetterly, notes me, that's correct. The direct hit would be on the general fund. There would still be some economic feedback effect.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Ed, is that where all of that is coming from? The property tax exemptions that were in the bill? Or plan in the bill? I mean, is that to explain all of the local revenue decline? The BAT by itself doesn't create a local revenue decline, does it?
Representative Witt, that is correct. It does not create a local revenue decline. The static local revenue decline is 89 million. That's what was input into the model. And that is minus 77 million, so you've lost less or given away less than you had programmed. That's largely due to the economic changes,
right,
which do generate some additional property tax revenue on the business side and also some additional revenues from other local revenue sources.
Bonnie, is this totally phased in? The dynamic analysis here is assuming that it's totally phased in. In other words, the transition has occurred and this is phased into behavior.
Representative Witt, yes, that's another good question. This is the end result of the total changes in the model. We assume 5 years hence from the time we implement the changes.
That brings to mind a question I have maybe for Dr. Weber, Dr. Ruffalo. We're looking at this, I think, in these numbers 5 years out. Obviously, a transition to a new revenue system and a tax system is a period of instability in itself, or the changes are being made and then absorbed. I guess, do you have a sense of what happens in the interim between now and the time this is fully phased in, how businesses in particular, let's say, respond to the imposition of this business activity tax during that transition period?
Representative Shetterly, I think the issue is not as easily answered as you might imagine. To some extent, it depends on how you shape the transition of the tax and how much time you give the businesses to adjust to it before you actually implement it. If you were to do this tomorrow, it would have a very different effect than if you were to place it in effect for 3 years from now and give people a lot of notice for that. The other substantial issue is likely to be how you treat the capital investment. Remember that under the business activity tax, capital investment, in effect, is expensed. It gets deducted immediately, and only depreciation is added in, whereas the current system has a number of differences with respect to how depreciation and capital are treated. That becomes one of the, I think, the more important transitions as to how you're going to deal with that. I think the people from the Department of Revenue are going to talk to you later about the issue of loss carryovers and how those are going to be treated. There are a number of specific transition issues that will determine, in effect, how the transition goes. The decisions that are made about how these are going to be handled, I think, is going to be a substantial part of what the transition is. With that aside, looking at it in terms of how it's actually being implemented, because it is based largely on the information that's generated for the federal income tax, the mechanics of it should be fairly straightforward. The other part of it that I would comment on is the relatively low rate again. You would expect that with a tax that is not at a high rate, it would not generate a tremendous amount of incentive to change activity or behavior so as to avoid it. So much of the transition should be relatively straightforward. It would be more of an issue of learning what the tax is, learning how to implement it and how to pay it and so on, as opposed to some other types of taxes where the high rate might substantially affect economic activity. Now, there are clearly some businesses that are going to be more affected by it than others, and they would probably have more incentive to take avoidance behavior and to change their activities than others. Again, without going into detail on each type of industry, mm-hmm. I don't think you can answer those kinds of questions.
Yeah, I would have added something about the industries, but Tony did it.
I guess another question I would have would be, of course, today is the day to look at this on the macro level. I know, mm-hmm. especially when you get into public testimony, we'll hear on the micro level the impacts of this. And they're going to be very real. But I guess on the macro level, looking out 5 years hence, the question I would have, could you comment, I guess, on the what you would likely see in the way of the state of the economy, the business climate? Is this relatively good for business, compared to the other tax systems you referred to for economic growth? We saw an increase of 12,500 jobs, I guess, the OTIM predicts on account of this. Some of those macro-level impacts, not so much based on the tax system, but the impact of the tax system on the broader economy.
Again, I think I would say it's up to you. If you put in a lot of exemptions, exclusions, and credits and create a lot of distortions, then you run into the problems that we see in a lot of the other taxes. I think if you can maintain it as a relatively broad-based, low-rate tax, All of the evidence that you find in the academic literature indicates that it would be a benefit, that it would improve the competitive position of the state, and that it would, in fact, lead to more stability and better overall competitive position. On the other hand, clearly it will also affect some industries differently than others. The net effect, however, is likely to be very positive.
Representative Fence.
On the macro, this is Ron Macro, could you make a preliminary conclusion as to whether this, if passed, would generally make taxes in Oregon more progressive or more regressive?
That's actually the next thing that we're going to get to.
Okay, let's go ahead.
Going to talk about.
Listen, we have questions on these points first.
I did very quickly, Mr. Chairman. Wouldn't you all describe the feedback effects here to be relatively mild? I mean, I don't see feedback
mild,
effects.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't it be fair to characterize them as relatively mild?
Representative Witt, members of the committee, yes. I think this shows them as being rather mild. I also think that this is a work in progress. There are some changes that I need to work on incorporating in the next week or so that would better get at the cross-deductibility concept for the business portion of the taxes. That is, the ability to export some of this tax to the federal government by way of deductibility. Also, there's a piece which I think is imperfectly modeled right now on the capital gains, rate reduction. Need to do some more thinking about how to implement the cost of capital change component of that.
If I may, one additional comment. We're looking here, in effect, still at static effects. There's no discussion of the impact of revenue stability or instability on the state. And I think while the feedback effects are relatively mild, they are positive, but I think the more important long-term effect is going to be on the issue of the stability of state revenue. And particularly if we're looking at the possibility of a fairly severe recession sometime in the next 5 or 10 years, I think that's really where you would see the substantial impact of the VAT as opposed to the current system.
I can one last thing, Mr. Chairman.
Since
there is the possibility that a VAT would make an Oregon business that is shipping a product out of state compete with another state, the state of Washington, for example, potentially somewhat less competitive because it has to absorb this tax, would there be any justification for creating some kind of a reduced tax or credit for sales that are origin, where the product is origined in Oregon and exported out of state?
Depends on whether you want an origin-based tax or a consumption-based tax. And the basic issue that you deal with at the state level is whether you want the VAT to be a sales tax, in which case you tax destination, you tax sales within the state no matter where they originate, and you exempt sales outside of the state no matter where they originate, or you do what was done in this case, which is to tax the origin. I think you certainly can mix them, but you're really moving away from the conceptual base of the tax, which is that it is an activities tax based on the origin of the activity. You can make all kinds of adjustments. My warning would be that once you start tinkering like that, the incentive for more tinkering because of equity concerns and other issues becomes substantial, and I think that's the effect that we observed in Michigan, that they started out with a fairly broad-based tax. They started granting a few exemptions here, a few exemptions there, a credit here, a credit there, and over a period of time, they have ended up with what is, I think, referred to as something of a nightmare and has led to the incentive to eliminate the tax.
Over 23 years.
Over 23 years.
Weber.
Just one other comment on the competitiveness. There are two other things that I think maybe are part of this discussion. One of the things that you're buying with this is an ability to reduce the personal income tax, which, and given both our dependence on the personal income tax and the high rates that we have as an income tax, there is evidence that reducing the personal income tax makes a state overall more competitive. So in a sense, you're buying some competitiveness with that. And the other thing is the thing that Tony just mentioned about the stability. If you have a stable public service, public sector, there are some competitive I believe there are some competitive advantages to having a revenue system which is more stable rather than...
Like a good university system.
Oh, I wasn't going to point out
that. What a spot.
For instance.
But I'll take, I think that would be a good example.
Representative Bates.
Mr. Chair, does the elimination of the corporate income tax modify that competitive situation? I mean, is there much of an effect of the corporate income tax as far as products leaving Oregon and being sold in other states?
As far as I know, the corporate income tax generally is viewed as being a poor tax at the state level. And one of the reasons is its instability, you know, the rapid fluctuations. I don't think it has a huge impact on the competitiveness. The effect of the change that we're observing here, however, is the corporate income tax is typically viewed as being a tax on capital. And so there is some shift of the tax from the capital base to a more wider base, all productive assets, labor and land being included. And so you do end up with something of a shift. In effect, you're reducing the net tax on capital. And I think the feedback effects, if you look at the model, would probably show that there's an increase in the amount of investment in the state, which is one of the reasons why you get the higher levels of employment and so on.
Well, it didn't sound like you were about to...
No, I'm just saying it does. The OTM feedback effects, the next to last line there, is a $53 million increase in investment. So that's exactly...
$53 million increase in investment?
That's because of lower cost of capital. Remember that the corporate income tax had the largest feedback effects of the shocks that we looked at initially.
Just to follow up, if we go to a single sales factor for the corporate income tax, we don't have payroll and land involved. Does that affect it any further? It's getting more and more complicated. We ask more questions.
Oh, it'll
get more. Shouldn't be doing this. Probably.
No.
I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you,
right now the corporate income tax is based on I think 50% sales and 25% payroll and 25% land. Mm-hmm. Or holdings in the state.
Mm-hmm.
When we looked at a bill, I believe went to a single sales factor. Where it dropped the other 225s, which would affect some businesses more than others. How would that change and mixture affect this, if at all? What does OTIM say?
Has someone talked to him?
Mm-hmm. OTIM has not spoken on this.
But he will.
He will.
So, the issue on, for example, if you look at Michigan has a super sales factor. I believe it's 70%.
70%.
70%, 15-15. So you would apply that apportionment to these other components. The one thing, though, to keep in mind about the rationale is that it is a business activity tax which is tied to economic activity. So there is some link there with the factors. But there isn't anything that says you can't adjust that apportionment factor to meet other policy goals.
Going back to Representative Witt's question, universities, for instance, and Dr. Weber, your comment about public services being an aspect of competitiveness and the general health and well-being of the economy. I guess one of the things, and I won't say that I'm so wrapped up in this that it keeps me awake at night, but one of these things that you do consider is that we've not seen a recession since Measure 5, I guess, basically, where the state general fund is bearing now not only the cost of the services that it was bearing in the 80s when we were last in a serious trough, but now we have the K-12 system funded 70% through the general fund as well. And a very concern, a great concern, I think, of mine anyway, that underlies my interest in looking at this from a stability perspective, getting away from the particulars of the tax, the fact that that may be something that we feel greatly. It would be my concern if we get into especially a longer-term downturn in state revenues, relative to the growth in demand, or at least the continuing pace of demand, where we've not seen that happen in the post-Measure 5 world with the state bearing the extent of the K-12 costs that we have. Not a question, but a comment. And I guess, too, then the impact of that certainly on competitiveness, on business location and recruitment and what have you. Okay, just something to ponder. We've got another page of OTIM.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The flip side of that first page shows the household distribution effects of the tax package change. And looking at this table, the second column shows the distribution of numbers of households or percentage of number of households in each of these income groups. The third column shows what those households' baseline share of this net household income measure are by household group. The next two columns show some of the effects of the tax package change. The fourth column shows the distribution of the total change in this net household income measure as received by each of the household income groups. So this question tells us, of that total plus $277 million net household income change, how was it distributed? The last column shows the change in each household's baseline net household income as a percent of that baseline. So, for example, the lowest income group would receive a 3.6% increase in their net household income measure. The highest income group receives a 0.9% increase in their net household income measure. That's net of taxes now. And in between, you've got a mixture. In fact, it shows that two of the household income groups, the two just below the top, actually experienced a net reduction in their net household income. The result of this related back to the household tax burden distribution that we looked at with OTIM and that we mentioned at the beginning of this talk today, is that, if you recall, it looked kind of this shape with a relatively higher tax burden on the low income end, and again, relatively higher at the high income end, and a little bit bowl-shaped in between. This change tends to flatten out the two ends, two edges of the bowl, and make it more of a flat line.
Mr. Chairman, I might add that keep in mind that this is not just the bath. This is the package, right. The entire package. And there are elements of the package that are clearly targeted at that below 14,000 income group, and that's a big factor in pushing that their net income up.
By the same token, taking the work in progress, we can modify the targets of the on the personal income side to adjust the effects that we see here. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the shot in the dark, and this is what we hit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Chair,
Representative Hennis,
I think it's a pretty good shot.
A few feathers.
there's a spot that shuts
back
here.
Is the significant increase here in the over 126,000 bracket, is that largely due to capital gains reduction?
Representative Witt, members of the committee, that is, I think, the biggest share of that. They benefit most from the capital gains tax reduction. They also benefit from some of the other broader base components, but proportionally they benefit much more from the capital gains relief component.
Representative Ford, you have a question?
Yeah. No, I have more of a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. One other thing we had talked about earlier was that this tax reform package also, although it's not in the bill, was taking into consideration the fact of the recent ballot measure that we passed.
Measure 88.
Measure 88, and so that does affect some of these other income groups disproportionately.
Yeah. I assume, how does Measure 88 fit in with these figures? That's a good question. Does it assume Measure 88 and then this is on top of that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, not yet. That's OTIM's homework for the week.
Okay. So the numbers could look different then when you factor in the Measure 88. In fact, wouldn't Measure 88 likely... Mm-hmm. Help, I guess, those two income groups that are shown as sustaining the loss of income on this chart?
Mr. Chair, that would be my first call. I would think would pick up that middle portion of the distribution a bit.
Representative Bates first.
Probably the same question, maybe not.
What?
Well, it, you know, it's, this seems like an anomaly that we see the highest income people starting to pick up again from this. Do you think the ballot majority will affect that also? Will it make it worse? Or better, I mean, how you look at it.
Representative Bates,
I don't mind that.
The key here is the change as percent of the baseline income.
Yeah.
The $180 net tax reduction that people get from Measure 88 means relatively more at a lower income level than a higher income level. So I don't think it would change the picture that much, especially for the higher income groups, but probably in the middle it would pick it up a little more.
Representative, what you question?
Yeah, of course, Measure 88's, I appreciate that it will change some of these numbers, but it doesn't change the numbers as far as what this bill will do. Isn't that correct, Ed?
President Witt, that's correct.
Okay, well, I guess that clarifies my question. Okay. So, but it won't even if you put Measure 88 in the, I assume you put Measure 88 in the baseline, isn't that right? Well, we'll look. We'll ask Oakton to work on that for the weekend.
Wouldn't change the change. These are all changed from the baseline.
Yeah.
You put Measure 88 in the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it wouldn't affect that last call.
Okay.
You did that, unless you look at it as an entire package.
Unless you look at it. That's interesting. Okay. Starting last November.
Right.
Okay. I want to get up our Department of Revenue folks. Thank you very much. Very, very interesting information. This is kind of fun. We shoot in the dark, and now we turn the lights on and see what we get. Now, as Deborah and Bob Alexander are coming on, we've got a friend here who's going to join us for these hearings as well. And I got him at the Warner Brothers store in Chicago last week. And when we hear testimony that we like, this is what he does.
Batman.
It's the Batman. That's right. The Batman. Yeah.
You must be careful because I do have an Eeyore doll that. Oh. I may bring him in when we hear testimony we don't like.
Deborah.
Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. With me is Bob Alexander, who's the program manager in the corporation section, and he's going to actually start off and talk about some of the administrative issues.
Mm-hmm. Please.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm going to be talking about administering the bill as is written today, so we can go from there. This bill, when we sat down and looked at it, is not unlike the Oregon corporate income taxes that exist today. You start with federal taxable income. You make additions, subtractions, modifications. Where appropriate, you apportion or you allocate income. You use that base or that number you come up with to compute a tax with a rate, and you compare it to the payments that are made, and you determine if billing goes out or refund check goes out or there's no additional activity need to be done. So it really is a similar process, and it uses information that we're used to getting. So in the long term, we feel very comfortable with administering a tax like this after the phase-in because while it's not a tax we're used to, it uses information and our staff, we feel, can be trained and move into this arena. However, the implementation would be an issue for us. We would have to build a brand new return processing system with our computers. We would have to do that while the corporation excise tax system was still in existence and we were still running our processes because the returns are filed a year after the year that they do their business in. So we would be running our corporate return processing system and banking our money and doing all this stuff while we were starting to accept payments and implement and train the public in this new system. So we would have a crossover time there. A lot of work would need to be done as far as setting policy, administrative rules, training our staff, and probably most important, training the business community on what the tax is, what it says, what we expect, and how we're going to administer it, and getting input from them to make these original decisions. At a bare minimum, it would take us 18 months to do this. That would mean we would have to take resources from other places in the department that are doing stuff that we're supposed to be doing now and focusing on this. We'd much rather have 3 years. 36 months would be very nice for us. That would allow us to implement the system, get the process going, make the decisions, and notify the business community of what we were doing before the tax went into effect. That's all I have. During the process of looking at this bill, we developed a form just to see what administration would be like, and Deborah's going to talk about that form and where the information comes from and how we would use it. And I think you have that in your in front of you.
Mr. Chair, each of you should have actually three different forms, and if you have nothing else to do over the weekend, you could practice filling these out. But the business activity tax return is the one with the large question mark on the front. And it really is just a very rough approximation of what we think the bill is saying. I won't go through it in detail, but you'll notice that it starts with business income, which the bill defines as federal taxable income. And also in your packet, you have a U.S. corporation income tax return of Form 1120. And in various places, there are circled numbers. These correspond to the line numbers on the business activity tax return, as well as the last page of the business activity tax return has a matrix of where the information comes from on the federal return. So all of the information needed to fill out the business activity tax return as the bill is written is found either on the federal tax return itself or with one exception, and that's appearing on the Form 940, which is the federal unemployment tax return that's filed annually. If we were to administer this, we would do similar forms for partnerships, S corporations, and so forth, and we think those numbers would also be
okay. That answers my question, because this is looking at the corporate income tax. We need to be straight up, and the VAT would apply to currently what are pass-through entities that would pay a tax at the entity level, and so I guess it's one thing to look and find this information on the corporate tax return. You're saying that the same corresponding information would be available on the partnership returns or the whatever other individuals might be paying or other entities.
Chairman Shetterly, that's true. We're not all the way through this yet. Our next stop is the partnership return and then the Schedule C taxpayers to trace that back directly.
And then, Mr. Chair, finally, the last form is an existing Form 20 for tax year 2000. This is what the corporations file now. The apportionment schedule is page 3 and 4 of that, and that would remain the same as we understand the bill to work, so they would still be doing the apportionment.
Questions for either of these? I guess to summarize what I hear, you need some time.
That's correct.
And you need some money.
That's correct.
But if you get time and money, you can do anything.
Yes,
well,
Chair, we can do it.
And of course, I guess what I would say is we always have the choice to do nothing, which in case that takes care of your costs. I suppose if you were to transition to anything, you'd have transition expenses and the same kind of issues. So I take it these are not specific to the BAT. These are just general issues of cost and to transition to any kind of new system if we were to go that direction.
Mr. Chair, that's true. And I think the key thing is as we transition in tax systems, we need to be aware of the people that are affected so they can make the decisions in their business.
All right. Folks, we're out of time. I want to thank everybody for a very enlightening macro discussion. We'll get some more of this on Monday, and then we will invite public testimony, so we'll find out more next week. Adjourn.